There is a perception out there about the pharma industry that it's only focused on profit.
Welcome to AI for Pharma Growth, the podcast from pioneering pharma artificial intelligence entrepreneur, Dr. Andre Bates. This show aims to demystify AI for all those in biopharma, from startup biotech right through to big pharma. Each episode focuses on all things AI and future tech related to help pharma execs to navigate through the and benefit from the sometimes confusing but magical world of AI-powered tools to grow and get real-world results.
Today's episode is The Future of Pharma, a provocative perspective. Healthcare is changing at an unprecedented rate. We've got exciting new technologies and techniques that have actually opened the doors to novel medical interventions and approaches. We've got a greater emphasis on patient outcomes, expanded access, greater affordability, combined with artificial intelligence advances and all the big data we now have, and shifting customer expectations. This is creating a perfect storm in the world of healthcare and pharmaceuticals. Navigating it will require radical and far-reaching change for the pharmaceutical industry, and this is something it's been historically slow to accomplish. My guest today is Mike Ryan, who is the Vice President of Eversana. I actually met Mike sitting next to him on a flight, and we had the most interesting conversation. So you should always talk to people on the flight beside you, because you never know what collaborations that can lead to. Welcome, Mike. It's so great to have you on the show today.
Oh, it's really great to be on the show. Thank you very much for inviting me. And yes, I totally agree. You should speak with the person beside you on a flight. And certainly, if you have anything like as great a conversation as we do, it's very, very rewarding.
It was very much. Now, I know a little about your background, but could you tell the listeners about your background and how you ended up in your current role?
Sure. Well, I started off my career in clinical trials, in actual fact, and spent 25, 26 years in that space and very much enjoyed it. It's an incredibly encouraging space to be in, because you have a great insight as to what's going to happen in medicine. But one of the interesting things about it, I suppose, and something that I've learned since I left that space and joined more the commercial side of the industry, is that in clinical trials, we're very much focused on getting regulatory approval, i.e. the drug are checking and ensuring, rightfully, of course, that the drug is safe and effective.
Yeah.
What, of course, has happened whilst I was in the clinical research industry is there's been an increasing focus on the cost of provision of healthcare, and obviously on the cost of pharmaceuticals, and particularly over the last number of years where we've seen those costs go up. There's plenty of reasons, and I'm sure we could do another two podcasts as to why the cost of drugs has been continuously increasing. None of them as simple as people, I think, might think that they are. But ultimately, what has happened then in the last, I guess, 15 years or whatever, is that there's an increasing focus on managing cost of drugs in the industry. And as a result, things like NICE in the UK have been established to control those. So we'll come back to those, I'm sure, in a while. But ultimately, I wanted to explore, after I'd sort of really worked in various different clinical research companies and software companies aligned with those, I wanted to look at how the principles of what I did in the CRO industry could potentially help in the commercial side of the pharmaceutical industry, which I think, by the very nature of the type of drugs we're developing, is rife for change right now. So a number of very well-known, very well-respected individuals had gotten together to form the company I currently work for, Eversana, to really with the key objectives of transforming how drug commercialization takes place, and ensuring that, in particular, the revolution that's occurred in the biotech industry and the revolution that's occurred in the types of drugs that we're developing can be catered for in a completely different way from how commercialization had worked in the past. And of course, much of that was based on, you know, large blockbuster drugs generating tons of revenue. So ultimately, I started working here just over 3 years ago, and it really has been an extraordinary and very, very exciting time to see some of the products that I worked on in clinical now hitting commercial, but also then understanding the challenges that face companies as they try to commercialize their products globally.
Yeah.
So it's been a fantastic career so far. I'm very grateful to it for it. And, you know, the one thing I will say about it all is it does encourage me, the type of work and the types of drugs that are being developed out there. It's just extraordinary, just extraordinary. And now I think our job collectively is to make sure that we have equitable access to those drugs right across the globe.
Yeah. There are amazing drugs coming through, even, and also vaccines, you know, cancer vaccines. And there's so many really interesting drugs that are very powerful coming through. And the majority of pharma CEOs do still see this as the number one driver of revenue growth is new products. And so obviously they're still investing heavily in R&D, but we're not seeing as good a results as we used to. And that's been kind of helped a bit with things like aggressive M&A and price increases, extensions, and so on. But when we look at all the things going on in the space, such as, I don't know if you've heard of Grail, for example. They're a company I met recently. In fact, they just were on my podcast, and they have a single blood draw to predict 50 different types of cancer in people with no symptoms. So, you know, we're using AI. And so these new companies that are doing these amazing diagnostics are going to be catching patients much sooner, which means that we're going to have a lot less of some of the chronic conditions that are out there. And I've mentioned this on my podcast before, but one of my friends in London is an architect that is basically making houses that have artificial intelligence in the bathroom mirrors, toilets that do urine and feces analyses every day. And although they're expensive homes right now, that kind of technology will start to come down. So I feel like that all of these changes, and of course, we've also got the DTX and nanobots and all of these other things going on, are going to put a lot of pressure on the existing model that pharma have. So taking all of that, and there's a lot more going on, what do you think that means for the pharma industry?
Well, I mean, everything you said just there is absolutely true. It's, again, just as good example of our conversation we had in the flight.
Yeah.
But what it means effectively is, whilst there is a big focus on growth in R&D, the types of drugs that are being developed are becoming more and more niche, right?
Rare
disease and whatever. And even oncology, and there's a great book out there called on cancer called The Emperor of Maladies. And it really gets into the idea of the fact that cancer is a very broad name for a wide variety of diseases.
Yes.
So people are getting much more down to the molecular biology of disease and treating very specific forms of cancer in a very, very specific way. And that's great. And it's, in fact, cancer is a perfect example. I know
there's
a report in the Wall Street Journal a few weeks ago citing the fact that cancer mortality is down by one third since 1991. Now, I would argue, and I don't think many people have disagreed with me here, that's down to a number of things. Number one, as you say, diagnostics. We're actually going in and we're discovering people have cancer much earlier in the cycle, and consequently treatments are more effective the earlier discovered. Secondly, the treatments themselves have improved significantly. But what CEOs of pharma now also notice is this idea of a drug that's going to, you know, guarantee you, like Lipitor was, whatever it was, $17 billion a year at peak. That type of drug just isn't going to necessarily fly anymore.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you had a product like Lipitor, whatever it was, $17 billion, as I said, a year or whatever, you could have a sales force, you could have a commercialization sort of aspect that it's a rounding error in comparison with the revenue that was being brought in.
Yeah.
If you're dealing with a niche disease that's been suffered by, you know, a couple of hundred or a couple of thousand people in any given country or region, you still have to influence a whole series of people. You still have to do a lot of work in order to get the word out about this product after having spent...
billions to get it to market, same as the other ones were,
With a vast failure rate. I think every product that goes into the pipeline, every 1,000 products that go into the pipeline, maybe three make it through full clinical development pipeline.
Yeah.
So the risk-reward ratio in pharma is very, very high. And as I said, then what we've done in the last 15 years, to go back to my opening monologue, was that we created then a further a kind of step to go through. You had to not only prove safety and efficacy, but now you've got to prove economic benefit of the product.
Yes.
So that's killed off a whole of the Me Too products and Me Too development. But what it's also done is it means that your risk is still there in terms of your regulatory risk. But then you've got to wait another while in order to get economic approval, as it were, in country. And in Europe, that's a particularly difficult thing.
Actually, I saw yesterday in one of the pharma magazine alert things about Canada, you know, a huge number of drugs aren't even going to be introduced in Canada because the reimbursement environment is so challenging.
Economics and the absolutely, the economics are substantial. Now, again, I'll go back a step.
Yeah.
You're going to have to, as a responsible biotech or pharma company in terms of getting to market, even before you've got regulatory approval, you've got to start building up your commercial team. How, if I get regulatory approval, how am I going to shape the market? How am I going to get the product out there? How am I going to develop materials that are compliant and so on? And that's, you know, you look at the US, one sort of approval gets you going. Whereas in Europe, you know, we get EMA approval, but then we've got to go to the individual countries. And of course, each individual country has got different economic circumstances
going
on at one time. And as a consequence of that in Europe, you know, you may get onto the German market 100 or so, 150 days after regulatory approval, after having gone through the negotiations and price with the German authorities. But if you live in Poland, where it's highly likely some of are a good chunk of the clinical research that would have gone into the development of the product, it may well be up to 700, 800 days after EMA approval before you get access to that. To me, as somebody who's very proud of the industry that I'm in, that's a real shame.
Yeah.
That's something that I even in the CRO industry where you're close to it, this never even entered, well, it didn't enter our consciousness as much as getting approval from the EMA, but certainly where you've got a whole lot of Polish patients that have contributed to the clinical development of a particular product.
Yeah.
And then not to be able to access that for a couple of hundred days after it's approved.
It's crazy.
It's really unfair.
Yeah.
Very unfair. Very wrong. And then not to mention, you know, access across, you know, the Africa, if even people bother about that.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's part of why I guess everybody's got to start thinking about this differently, the cost of commercialization.
Yeah.
So again, if you're a biotech company and you want to bring on all of the commercial activities, you're going to have to go out and get an agency. You're going to have to hire a chief commercial officer. You're going to have to hire a complete sales force. You're going to have to hire a particular chunk of medical affairs individuals. You're going to have to take on all of the post-regulatory requirements that are put on you by the agencies as well. Hiring and maintaining all of these people is just, it's wildly expensive. And again, you're doing a lot of that hiring at risk.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there's then the additional side of things where, you know, you see companies have gotten, you know, good phase three data, but then, you know, the FDA comes along and puts them on clinical hold whilst they're trying to catch up with some of their backlog, etc. So suddenly companies that felt, you know, all the signals were good, it was all looking great, they're on hold. That hold is, you know, 6, 12, 18 months.
Yeah.
Suddenly the economics of that company just aren't viable any longer when they're trying to retain a commercial team.
Yeah.
In the US, they can close that down, but of course that has a very negative effect on their share price and the market perception. In Europe, much more difficult again, because we have rightfully, in my opinion, you know, employment law in Europe that offers a lot of protection to the employees and so on. So it's a further risk and it's a further challenge then for companies of that nature to look beyond only where the you know, the most immediate and largest sources of revenue actually exist.
Yeah, I remember well over a decade ago now, 2009, I did a project for the board of a Japanese pharmaceutical company, mm-hmm. and they got me to basically analyze three different models, commercial models for them. And they were looking at a completely virtual model, a semi virtual and a proper normal bricks and mortar model. Yeah. And the completely virtual model obviously was a lot more cost effective, but also you still need one or two people. I think it was legally, it was pharmacovigilance people on the ground, but I think it was only two that you needed. And it was just interesting to me that they were thinking about that way back then already, thinking about how to create a completely virtual pharma in some markets so that they could have footprint in those different markets. So it'd be interesting to see what the boards today, if any of them are thinking laterally and differently about this whole issue.
Yeah, we're certainly seeing that, and it's at the core of what we do, because we're trying to say to companies, look, you don't need to create all of this bricks and mortar, because we have a platform that's reusable. In fact, it's very similar to how CROs were 25 years ago. And you know, again, as a proud CRO guy, you know, I would argue that despite the fact that there's occasionally, you know, tension between CROs and the sponsors, you know, without CROs, many of the drugs that we've brought to market just couldn't have been brought to market because, again, the economics
have been worked
out. So we see the same in commercial, in that it's the same environment, highly risky environment, one where talent is important. But very often you're creating a commercial organization, and particularly if you're a new biotech or whatever, where that organization isn't necessarily going to be fully utilized. In other words, people are going to be busy all the time because the infrastructure that you have to have underneath your commercial teams or whatever just simply isn't going to be busy enough to support that. So what you want is a reusable platform that can be fully utilized across a number of different clients.
Yeah.
Until, of course, you as the biotech sponsor maybe have two or three products then in the market, in which case then you have your support infrastructure is appropriate for a broader selection of people.
Yeah.
The other model you mentioned then is very often where companies will outsource to other individual organizations that have in-country infrastructures, particularly
important,
or they will sell the product to large pharma. That may be a solution for some people. My worry and my desire, in fact, for the market is I want new Pfizer, I want new Novartis, I want companies emerging like Amgen did or whatever, like Genentech before they're acquired by Roche, to become the new large companies. I want them reinvesting in themselves and their
brand. Yeah, and looking at things differently.
And indeed, and growing from a different... If you look at some of the large pharma companies and how they've grown and evolved, there's mergers, acquisitions, and they inherit kind of a set of operating procedures that they're often trapped within. They're often imprisoned within those, for very, very good reason. But it then reduces their ability to be agile and to be able to deal with the smaller products, the more niche indications, and in many respects. And it's not that it discourages them, but they have shareholders, they have Wall Street to satisfy.
Yes.
And it makes the argument for them investing in some of their smaller niche organ indications or disease or whatever much more difficult.
Yes, for sure.
So I want companies evolving without that sort of historic
bias.
And they then can be the vanguard together with service providers like us.
Yeah.
New way of reaching patients quickly. No change to the safety and
of course
arguments or any of those things. Just as you say, being able to say, you know what, I do want to approach the market from a virtual perspective. That's a much different prospect for a new biotech company than it is for a Japanese company that's 800 years old.
Yeah. It's very interesting. I remember I had a client 20 years ago, and we were really working on, you know, new ideas and innovation. And his lament was, it's so frustrating because to him it felt like you're on the Titanic, you're the captain of the Titanic, you see the iceberg, you're spinning the wheel as fast as you can, but it's so slow to move that ship that, you know. And so, yeah, it is. There's just so much infrastructure there. It makes it so hard to be agile in the,
impossible. You know, you're dealing with, I empathize enormously with the large pharma companies. You're dealing with the health and well-being of millions and millions and millions of people. Yeah. There is a perception out there about the pharma industry that it's only focused on profit and whatever. And I can tell you from the inside.
I agree. It's not. Yeah, absolutely not. No.
But it is. And you then have a community out there that are quite happy to take litigious actions against the pharma companies because, well, they've got millions and millions and millions of dollars. And all that's done is it's created an environment of conservatism within them. So they're, you know, again, they're dealing with all of this historic procedural stuff that they have to do.
Yeah.
It's probably outside the nuclear industry, the most regulated industry in the world.
Yes.
And then you've got, you know, the perception of the broader community out there.
Yeah.
And from their perspective, the other key thing, which we talked about earlier, is you then have a company that has to commercialize or sell their product not to the end user, but to somebody who is prescribing the product for a patient.
Yeah.
And that person is, again, always a highly educated individual that is trained scientifically. And I always say training someone scientifically means developing or creating a degree of inbuilt cynicism in that individual.
Yeah.
When you're doing your scientific training, it's all about challenging, you know, the status quo, challenging and so on. So they're automatically going to be a lot more conservative in their decision making and so on.
Yeah.
And you're asking them to prescribe a product when, you know, and again, when you start getting to rare and orphan, you know, they may not see a patient for a year and a half. And suddenly you're asking them to prescribe a product and treat a product in that's completely new and so on.
Yeah.
So the amount of education that has got to go on that can't be seen as influencing is very, very important. And one other layer to add on to that is, whilst the patient isn't necessary, is the end user and so on, but patients themselves now are becoming a lot more, you know, deeply invested in their regimen. So they're going to go on and start looking at all of the information that's out there. So the pharma company is highly regulated again in what it can say, and there's massive differences between what they can say in the US and what they can say in Europe and how you control all of that. But then the people that are making comments about it and witness the COVID vaccine aren't regulated and pretty much say whatever the hell they want.
Yes. Yeah. There were some shocking examples during COVID. I mean, I just, some words failed me with some of the things I saw and things being said that weren't regulated. But
words didn't fail me, but we can't use any.
So what do you think are the biggest? I mean, there's a lot of challenges out there. What do you think are the biggest challenges that pharma are going to face as they move forward into this new world of faster diagnosis and everything else?
I think one of the big challenges is going to be about information, right? Mm-hmm. Informing people, managing that information appropriately, using the information that will benefit patients as much as possible, but in an environment where information is highly regulated. Again, if you look at the US, GDPR, I would personally contend GDPR's effect in Europe has actually had a hindering effect on the industry and healthcare in general. Because, you know, the market as a result of that in Europe cannot operate as a true single market. Now, there's other reasons for that, which you mentioned earlier on price controls in individual markets and whatever. But just sharing data across borders is extremely difficult. And we saw the collapse of the of some of the health sharing, data sharing sort of capabilities between Europe and the US. A couple of years ago, and I don't think we've addressed that properly either. But ultimately, it will be about trying to get and offering patients appropriate, and doctors, and healthcare providers in general, appropriate information.
Mm-hmm.
Being able to let doctors know about the benefits and the capabilities of new products in an environment where we're not selling it per se, but we're informing them about them and allowing them and giving them all of the information necessary to make a very, very informed decision about a very, very important thing that they're about to do. If you think about it, you administer a drug to somebody, you're effectively altering their bodily biochemistry. So I think that's going to be important. Time that doctors have is becoming less and less. So the access that companies have to be able to inform them about that is different. Obviously, the old ways of doing things post-Sunshine Act have changed significantly, and that's maybe not a bad thing. So what the industry's got to think about a lot more is how it's going to provide useful information to doctors and healthcare providers and indeed patients about the products that they have developed, and monitoring and managing that feed the feedback loop from all of that. Because ultimately, again, if you're providing a drug to a patient, you have to make sure that that patient is being taken care of, and that that patient isn't one of those unique cases, one of those exceptions to all of the various biological rules that have governed how the clinical trials, et cetera, were conducted.
That leads into another hot topic, which maybe we'll do another podcast on, which is this whole diversity in clinical trials, clinical trial populations. You know, most of the clinical trial participants are, you know, white male between certain ages, because it's quite, you know, more dangerous to give it to women and so on. But the diversity of the ethnicities is not very representative in the trials.
I think the agencies have certainly tried to do that. Like, I can tell you that, and I'm not sure I can tell you which one, but I can tell you that one of the COVID vaccines would probably have hit market, a couple of weeks earlier had they not been asked by the agency to get a more diverse population out there. And I think they are. It's a very tricky subject. And the other thing that nobody mentions is that in poorer areas or less more economically deprived areas, doctors don't have the time or the ability to participate in clinical trials. So that's, the pharma companies and the CROs want everybody to participate.
And
there's a lot of complex reasons for that. Yeah, we can have another podcast about that. But the agencies are doing their best about it. But, you still then have, this idea, to go back to the idea of information. You're telling everybody about the importance of clinical trials, but then you've got other parties out there saying, well, you don't want to be the guinea pig that they're testing an experimental drug on. Again, everybody calls the COVID vaccine an experiment, or, well, some people call the COVID vaccine an experimental drug. My God, it's the most administered drug in the world right now. And it's crazy. And touch wood, it's gone relatively well so far.
Yeah, I have as many boosters as I can get.
same here. But it is that information thing, I think, is a unique challenge. And, some of the solutions, again, the pharma company can take a step back and can use various intermediaries like, agencies of record, companies like ourselves to be able to say, we have taken what the pharma company has done and we have vetted it ourselves and we believe that this is appropriate and so on, and we can put that information out. So that there's that one degree extra of separation and validation by service providers like ourselves. And again, with the dynamic of how information is being disseminated, the ability to track patient information after they've taken it, what we certainly have is a much better feedback loop. And I would argue that the idea of that feedback loop needs to be expanded, and would say within the European Union, for example, that there's absolutely no issues whatsoever about cross-border data sharing, anonymized, of course, in order to ensure that we are finding out as much as we can about a product in vivo, in the actual environment that it's in.
That leads into data and real-world data. I think I'd be curious to see, there's so much that, again, another podcast could be done on healthcare data, but the patient groups are trying to take responsibility for their own data. I'm seeing, grassroots efforts there. But I kind of see this vision of the digital twin. Each of us will have a digital twin or a completely synthetic data version of ourselves. And so when we get to that point, because, we have digital twins of hearts, we have digital twins of different organs, not as a complete human, but once we have a digital twin of ourselves, which I don't know when, but I'm 100% sure it will happen eventually, then we can test everything on everyone in the population that fits the criteria without ever putting a drug into a person.
Yeah, I think there's certainly, I mean, look, again, I go back to my very first lecture in biology in university, and we had a really wonderful lady, a real trailblazer in Irish academia called Professor Maura Mulcahy. She was professor of zoology and vice president of the university, and I'll never forget what she said. She said, if you learn nothing else in university, remember this. In biology, there are no blacks and no whites. It's just a series of grays. I think there'll always be the need for a biological model. However, really where I think your assertion is absolutely spot on in terms of a digital twin is we need to be able to have a standard way of expressing the condition and state and history of our health.
Yeah.
That we as the patient can share, and that it can be offered to the rest of society as a way of tracking society's health. And I don't mean country specific society,
yeah.
Society in general.
Yeah.
And in order to be able to, and a great case study, something we were involved in a number of years ago, but just to give you an example, you know, the diagnosis of a patient with a complex condition is very often a set of misdiagnoses on the way to that ultimate and correct diagnosis. And we talked about cancer earlier on, the earlier you die. With AI these days, they can analyze the data to determine that this particular patient at the very early stages of their diagnostic journey has a particular condition, right?
Yeah.
Not the one that they're being tracked on at the moment.
Yes.
That is a vitally important aspect. But in order to be able to do that, we have to have a data set that is capable of being analyzed. It's got to be at the population level.
Yeah.
So that what can happen then is the doctor, whether it be a GP or a specialist, can say, well, you've tried this, you've tried this drug, you've had no effect. You've had the following diseases and whatever. Looking at this and with the aid of AI, I think you may have something, whatever it may be, considerably more serious. So I'm going to refer you that way rather than sending out those memories.
Yeah, that's interesting. So I'm doing a project this year actually on doing something like that, but it's not at population level. So it's for a very specific niche condition, which is present in certain other conditions, but the company is having a very hard time, and 10% of the patients huge number of patients with another condition die of it undiagnosed. And it's because it's too expensive to send every patient with that condition to get tested for this, to scan, etc. And so we're using AI from medical records to identify patients before they've got any symptoms, and usually they don't for till the end. Which patients have got the highest probability that they will have this, go get these ones scanned. We don't know their names, but we can give their details to their doctor and they will be able to pick up who they are. So that will mean we can be very niche and targeted in finding the right patients to spend the extra money where, you know, the healthcare systems are all strapped, so they're not willing to just do scanning all the way across the board for these particular ones. But yeah, but as you're saying, if it was across the population and totally, imagine how much healthier as a population humans would be.
Yeah, again, there's this enormous distrust out there. I don't want to share my health data or whatever. And I think some of that comes from, you know, particularly in the US, people are concerned that their health insurance premiums will increase exponentially. And an inherent distrust of everybody. But again, I would challenge those individuals saying, okay, imagine we did share our health data universally in a blinded way. Don't you think that in finding diseases and treating diseases earlier at a population level, that the outcomes as a result are going to be better, and the health insurance companies will actually end up having to charge less because the cost of health administration will be lower? I think, you know, we are dealing with two, again, you know, the US versus rest of the world, social healthcare versus, you know, private healthcare in the US. You know, insurance companies have and provide access to anonymized data. You see companies like Optum Insights rightfully performing very, very well.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're providing you know, as near population level data as possible. And the, I said the benefit for that for the United States is many fold, but, you know, again, I go back to the COVID example recently. Like, ultimately, the United States was able to provide a lot more input into the development of vaccines, even though, you know, it was mainly European companies, two out of three, GSK and BioNTech. But ultimately, US companies or US data allows us to be able to find patients faster in clinical trials. And indeed, when it comes to real world, because of the way everything is coded in the US to facilitate the insurance companies, I can do that patient journey exercise in the US considerably more easily than I can do it in Europe. And I certainly I can do it with a population of 350 odd million, as opposed to trying to parse it out country by country and dealing with a different sort of way of coding healthcare in Europe.
Yeah.
So there's a lot to be said for information, and pharma companies, I think, are going to live and die by ultimately how they assess and utilize information and how they provide information. And if I was a CEO, that would be the sort of thing I'd be worried about. And then consequently, how that can be used to drive the capital cost of running my business.
Yeah. What about disruption? You know, where do you think, or how do you think pharma could be disrupted? Because disruption really comes from within.
Yeah, I think we're the biotech industry really has just been extraordinary in the last number of years in terms of the level of innovation that it's sort of brought out there. You know, first time launchers, companies that are launching product for the first time ever, has tripled in the last 10 years alone. And you know, again, you look at I keep going back to the COVID example. It's a real great example of the pharmaceutical industry saving the planet.
Yeah.
But if you look at all of the COVID solutions that came out, Moderna, BioNTech, and effectively an English university, aided and abetted by the commercial sort of capabilities of, you know, in Moderna's case, a lot of the U.S. government. In BioNTech's Pfizer and so on, and GSK, obviously, or AstraZeneca. So, you know, they're the companies that have developed these vaccines. They're the companies that have moved on and developed these solutions. And again, it's true of a lot of the bigger drugs that have been launched earlier. They've come through biotech. The true disruption, though, whilst they've produced great drugs, ultimately how we've then gotten those drugs out to patients has largely followed a playbook that's existed for many, many years. I want to see these biotech companies develop into the next multinational pharma companies and bring that sense of agility with them as they scale.
Yeah.
And again, I know I speak from a biased perspective, but I think the commercialization of these products and utilizing outsourcing as a way of doing that, I think is a perfectly valid way for them to continue to go to scale, but not to lose that sort of agile approach.
Yeah, that's true.
The diagnostics industry, as you say, I think it's another wildly important aspect of what we do.
That was something that surprised me about a decade or so ago, maybe two decades, where all the pharma used to have a diagnostics unit and then they all just sold them off. And it just didn't make sense to me at the time because it's like a lock and a key. You kind of need the two.
With the exception of our friends in Roche.
Roche have always been forward thinking.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I agree. I think the diagnostic side of it, and we're working with a client at the moment that's got a diagnostic element and obviously a pharmaceutical element in the treatment of Alzheimer's. And I think that's ultimately, I agree with you, it's a lock and key. Now, the diagnostic doesn't necessarily have to be a blood test kit, I think, anymore. We go back to data again and information, and the diagnostic can be much more data-driven.
Mm.
But, you know, again, I can see large pharma being advised, well, you know, the utilization of this diagnostic may or may not ultimately influence the choice of our drug. Our drug is the one that's the major revenue grower or whatever. Why don't we sell off that part of the business which is, you know, reasonably profitable, but nothing mm-hmm. like what we make in pharma. As we go back to more niche-based solutions, yeah. I would argue that diagnostics are really going to come front and center again, because again, diagnostics are about finding that needle in the haystack. And if you're going for rare, orphan, or whatever, the haystack is suddenly a hell of a lot bigger.
Exactly. And
in particular, when you're trying to do it at the earliest stages of the disease.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not against the idea of a broad test on newborns and whatever to try and help understand where their health could go, so that you've, as you say, in their digital twin that will grow yeah. with it, you could know from the very earliest stages, right, there's a potential yeah. off. But everybody's got to take a step back from this fear of, oh, the health insurance company, because I've done this, my yeah. child will never be able to get health insurance.
Yeah, yeah.
Everybody's got to step back from that and say, well, we absolutely anonymize this. All we do yeah. is we challenge that data set at a particular point, and we don't even do it ourselves. It's done sort of almost automatically by AI.
Exactly, yeah. Oh, and it's all anonymized from the beginning anyway. We don't have non-anonymized patient data, so.
Well, yeah. I agree. But so many people don't appreciate that. So
no, I know.
No, they'll be able to find who I am. They'll be able to get my address and my zip code and everything. It's like, oh, guys,
yeah, come on. Yeah. That's been taken out long before.
Yeah.
Well,
so the diagnostics, I think, is going to be important. And again, ultimately, where else do I see disruption? I see a lot of companies outside of pharma looking at pharma, kind of going, "Oh my God, what are you guys doing? We can build an entirely new car. We can build an entire new airplane. We can do that in no time flat in comparison with you guys." But you know, it's only when you get in there you discover. Yeah. You know, many friends of mine, when I start talking with them about sort of what governs clinical development,
yeah,
begin to appreciate it's a real big challenge.
It is, yeah. Wow. Well, thank you so much. I always enjoy talking to you, and I'm sure that there's several more podcasts we could do on multiple sections of this. For sure.
I hope so.
So if anyone wants to get in touch with Mike, head over to Eversana, EVERSANA.com, and you can see the wealth of things that they're doing there. And why I find him very interesting to talk to. There's so many things that they're up to. So thank you so much for your time again, Mike. Really appreciate it, and looking forward to our next one.
Thanks, Andrea, and thanks for shining a light in this part of the business. It's extraordinary. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of AI for Pharma Growth. If you have received huge value from this show, or maybe this episode has highlighted how you can use AI in your company, then we would love for you to support the show by leaving us a 5-star rating. Please make sure you hit the subscribe or follow button on your podcast app now to make sure you never miss an episode.